The Honorable Denise B. Kennedy.
Thank you. May be seated. And we see Mr. Kenley, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And is someone over at the Centennial Building? I want to make sure we see you before we start.
Yes, Your Honor. This is Ed Stockmeyer from the AG's office.
Okay, then this next case is A18-1222. It's State of Minnesota versus Joshua Elvin Peterson. And when you begin your argument, if you would please state your name for the record. You'll each have 15 minutes if you choose to use it, with rebuttal of 5 minutes. Mr. Kenley, are you ready to proceed? Mr. Kenley, we're not hearing you.
It's voice activated.
I'm here.
Okay, let's see if it switches over. We're still seeing Mr. Stockmeyer. No, you're not.
Are you speaking?
Yes, state your name, please, and start, and I'll stop you if it doesn't switch over, the view, that is.
Okay, I'm Rich Kenley. I'm here for the appellant. Are we ready for the argument, Your Honor?
Now we see you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, may it please the court and counsel. I'm Rich Kenley. I'm here for the appellant, Joshua Peterson. This whole matter arose out of a trooper sitting on the side of the highway watching for speeders. At the implied consent, he testified that he saw Mr. Peterson hop in his pickup truck, which was already running, and drive away. And he had a suspicion that he didn't have time to put his seatbelt on.
Well,
so we followed him.
Just a minute. That brings me to my first question. I want to make clear what the record is for this case. I don't think it includes the IC evidentiary hearing.
Well, Your Honor, the implied consent transcript was attached to my memorandum. It was not objected to at the trial court. It was used to show the inconsistencies in the trooper's testimony at the omnibus hearing, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're saying that it's part of the omnibus hearing record?
I do, Your Honor, yes.
Okay, I wasn't clear about that. Thank you.
It was attached to my memorandum. It wasn't objected to.
Thank you.
Okay. The difference between the initially, he pulled out of a gas station. At the omnibus hearing, he left the bar, the Hillbilly Bar in Battle Lake, Minnesota. The trooper then noticed that the third brake light was out, or at least that was his testimony, and followed the appellant. And then at the implied consent in his report, he didn't mention the speeding. At the omnibus, suddenly Mr. Peterson was also speeding. But no stop was made, and none of that was put in the initial report. Once they get to the house, Mr. Peterson goes inside his house. I've read the trial court order. What I ask you to review is something that the district court didn't address. The record is more extensive at the omnibus hearing. There was testimony from the wife, Mindy Peterson. Specifically, we got an exhibit 2, which showed on the evening of the arrest that the third brake light worked. The trooper looked at the photo, and that went into evidence without an objection. The trooper looked at the photo and said that was refracted light from the side lights. But if you go to 31 minutes and 35 seconds into the squad video, the door is opened so Ms. Peterson can retrieve something out of the vehicle. Those lights come on.
But counsel, if the officer said he thought the light didn't work, and the district court credited him saying that, does it matter if the light worked or not? I mean, isn't it what the officer believed at the time?
The officer saw somebody leaving the bar. Okay, we'll go to what the officer thought at the time. This is something else the district court didn't address in its order. At the omnibus hearing, I asked Trooper Wenzel, was this hot pursuit? He says, well, yeah, it was. He specifically said this was not hot pursuit at the implied consent hearing. But more importantly, when I asked the trooper if an arrest had been set in motion when Mr. Peterson was walking up to and walked into his house, he testified that no arrest was set in motion. And under State v. Paul, an arrest must have been set in motion for the for them to be able to do something. I would cite that. Page 5.
I think Paul is cited in the briefs, counsel. So would you go back a moment to your first issue, which I think is whether there is reasonable, articulable suspicion for the stop, right? Isn't that your first issue?
Yes.
Okay. So at what point in time would you say that the officer had stopped Mr. Peterson?
Well, Mr. Peterson pulled into his own driveway and stopped. There were no lights. There was no siren. So, I mean, I guess the stop would have come when the trooper said stop as he was walking into his house.
Right. And what does the record show that Mr. Peterson did when the officer said stop?
He walked into his house.
Okay. And there was a little bit more than that, wasn't there? Something about Mr. Peterson looking over at the officer?
That's what the trooper testified to.
Okay. Well, I think it's in the district court's findings of fact, too, right?
It is, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It is.
Okay. And so for that point, at that point in time, you know, this court has asked, as was the similar question in the implied consent appeal, whether there was reasonable articulable suspicion, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you say no because there are problems with each of the potential traffic violations, the seatbelt violation, the brake light, and the third would be the speeding. So, but back to Judge Kalatowski's question, I mean, it's a reasonable articulable suspicion, right? It doesn't have to be proof of an actual violation to support a stop, a brief investigative stop.
Understood, Your Honor.
So help me out there, counsel. I'm just trying to see why this court should come up to a different place than did, you know, the two district courts that have looked at this issue before, as well as a different panel of this court.
All right. The appellant walked away from what was described as a minor traffic offense. The trooper testified no arrest had been set in motion. I think that's crucial.
But that goes to the next issue, right? Doesn't the hot pursuit goes to what the officer did in terms of arresting Mr. Peterson,
okay,
right? So back to you want to move on to the second issue? Because I'm just trying to understand, like I said, why this court should resolve the first issue differently from the other courts that have already looked at it.
Okay. Going back to the first implied consent, the trooper said the brake light was out. I think we've demonstrated that it wasn't. That was all he wanted to talk to you about. That was the basis for the stop. As the case progresses, now there's speeding, and there was no confirmation of the seatbelt. If the officer has a suspicion that you might not be wearing your seatbelt, shouldn't he not try to confirm that you're not wearing a seatbelt before he pulls you over? Or can an officer or trooper look at anyone and say, wonder if he's not wearing a seatbelt without doing a visual confirmation? I think they're trained to and should actually confirm you're not wearing a seatbelt before they have a right to pull you over for that.
But how is he going to do that here? It's February 10th at 7:30 at night on a two-lane road. Right? So it's dark.
Well, correct. But the officer testifies that wasn't the basis for the stop. The basis for the stop was the non-working third brake light. I guess I have trouble believing. I think the trooper saw him leaving the vicinity of a bar and decided he wanted to follow him. That's my argument, because the brake light does in fact work, or did in fact work that evening. He did not confirm that he was speeding. He estimated visually, and he did not confirm that he didn't have a seatbelt. So when Mr. Peterson pulled into his yard, the trooper says, I wanted to talk to him about that brake light, which again we showed that the brake light did work. I think that this was not a reasonable suspicion. I think he had a hunch that Mr. Peterson had left the hillbilly bar and wanted to talk to him and didn't have a proper basis for a stop. That's my argument. If I haven't made that clear, I'm sorry.
So then we should disregard the district court's findings about each of those things?
I would just ask you to look at it anew under a de novo review, Your Honor, from the testimony that was presented at the omnibus. For my brief. All right. And again, just the issue of the arrest, and he pounds on the door. He scares the wife, he scares the children, says, "You're lucky I didn't kick the door in." There is testimony that was not addressed by the district court from the wife of the appellant, stating that the officer had to open a screen door to come into the house and came in 6 feet into the house to grab the appellant. Now, at that point, according to his testimony, he wanted to talk to him about a brake light, a petty misdemeanor offense. I fail to see how that justifies coming into somebody's home in what he admits was not hot pursuit, and when he also states that he had not set an arrest in motion. That's where the officer went too far. He should not have been able to do that, or he should not have done that. The district court, like as I said, did not address that in the order.
So the district court does not address the specifics of the wife's testimony that you just described. I think that's accurate. Yeah. But the district court does say that it found the trooper's testimony about what happened at the threshold to be more credible, or at least found the trooper's testimony credible. Let's put it that way. I think that's accurate.
I agree.
So I guess I'm trying to understand what role the wife's testimony plays in our analysis if the district court has already found the trooper's testimony to be credible.
I guess I just asked for a de novo review, Your Honor. Okay. It wasn't even addressed and no findings were made. And the last thing I'd like to mention, the Santana case dealt with somebody standing on their threshold dealing heroin. This case deals with somebody walking into their house after a petty misdemeanor traffic offense. And that's what I'd have for now. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. Mr. Stockmeyer? You're up.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing this morning on behalf of the state of Minnesota. I'd like to begin just by making a brief point about the stop, but then really talk about the arrest at the doorway to the house. When we're asking or analyzing whether the stop was lawful, it really does not matter what the trooper said he believed the basis for the stop is. The trooper's subjective intentions or motivations are irrelevant. That goes all the way back to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Wren. In a different part of our brief, I've cited, I believe it's in footnote 5. On page 9 of the brief, Scott versus United States. Quote, the fact that the officer does not have the state of mind which is hypothecated by the reasons which provide the legal justifications for the officer's action does not invalidate the action so long as the circumstances viewed objectively justify the action. So again, the point I want to make about the stop is what the officer testified as being the reasons subjectively which justified what he did, that doesn't matter. We're looking at the facts from an objective view. What would a reasonable officer do based on knowing all of those facts?
So when did the officer have probable cause to arrest appellant for the DUI in your estimation?
For the DUI, when he made those preliminary observations during the initial conversation when he's asking the appellant to come outside. He testified that he observed that the appellant's breath emitted an overwhelming odor of alcohol. The driver had a can of beer in his hand, which he had opened immediately after entering his house. His eyes were bloodshot, and he had an unsteady sway or gait. Given what the trooper testified as potentially evasive conduct prior to that point, as well as the totality of those observations, the officer had probable cause to arrest for a DWI at that point in time. And that's when he reached over and he grabbed the appellant and attempted to pull him out. The appellant resisted, and to maintain balance, because of the resisting arrest, the officer stuck his foot beyond the threshold of the door. I think really the lawfulness of that arrest can be justified in a few different ways, but there are two main ways. First, there's the line of precedent that begins with the Santana case, which holds that an arrest may be initiated and executed at the threshold to the home. The Minnesota Supreme Court has upheld this type of doorway arrest in the Miller case, the Patricelli case, the Howard case, and the Allion case, all of which are cited in the brief. Those cases apply the simple rule that an arrest supported by probable cause may lawfully occur at or in the doorway to a home without a warrant. This type of scenario where an arrest occurs at the doorway simply is not a home entry for the purposes of the Fourth Amendment. And that rule should really dispose of this case, because if the initiation of the arrest at the doorway is lawful, then certainly the officer has to have at least a reasonable amount of leeway to complete the arrest if the suspect is resisting. And so the fact that the officer's foot may have crossed the threshold to the home, I think that sort of de minimis encroachment is reasonable under the Fourth Amendment, and there's simply no home entry. Alternatively, if that is a home entry, if we're going to say just as a formal matter that's an entrance into the home, it's justified under the hot pursuit rule. And again, we're looking to the Santana case for that rule. In Paul, Morin, and Bauman, again, all cases that we've cited in the brief, this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have upheld warrantless home entries, actual entries into the home, based on probable cause to believe a suspect has driven while impaired, has fled on foot, or has obstructed process, and was trying to evade the lawful arrest by retreating into his home. In this case, Trooper Wenzel had probable cause to believe that the appellant had committed all three of those crimes. And it's undisputed that he was trying to evade arrest when he snuck into the home.
So what, counsel, help me out. What's the legal test for setting an arrest in motion?
I think the test would I guess the test would be whether, I guess I don't have an answer off the top of my head for when an arrest is set in motion, Your Honor. I would say in Santana, the suspect was standing in the doorway, the officers yelled stop, just as the officer did in here, and the court said that an arrest had been set in motion at that point in time.
Was she, maybe I remember the facts wrong, wasn't she under indictment in that case? For a felony. I mean, I'm just trying to get you to respond to the, I think the point that Mr. Kenley is trying to make is that here we have, at least arguably, this is his argument, and I don't mean to misstate it, but we have some traffic violations that normally would not result in apprehension at the doorway.
It wouldn't, but before the apprehension of the doorway here, the officer yelled, stop. The defendant had looked back and seen the officer. He continued to walk, and I believe the district court's findings were that he moved quickly towards his house, and they locked the door behind him. And so the issue is not that somebody can be arrested in their doorway because of a traffic violation. In fact, that would violate the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in Askaruth. The issue is that a suspect cannot evade a lawful action by an officer by running to his home. The Fourth Amendment does not incentivize active flight from law enforcement.
And I was trying to remember, too, is this a case where the officer does make some statements to Mr. Peterson about his behavior amounting to obstruction of legal process?
He does. During that initial, during their initial conversation, the officer is asking the appellant to come outside and speak with him. And he's saying, if you do not come outside, I'm going to consider you to have obstructed legal process, and I'm going to place you under arrest. And the appellant continued not to comply. And then when the arrest was initiated, when the officer went to grab Mr. Peterson, he resisted arrest with the aid of his wife, I may add.
Oh, okay. So maybe you are getting to the point I was trying to get to earlier. So at what point would you say their arrest was set in motion? So it's at the time that the officer grabs Mr. Peterson?
I think if you look at the Santana case, there might be a distinction between the arrest, when somebody's placed under arrest, and for the purposes of these rules, when an arrest has been, quote, set in motion. The Supreme Court in Santana said the arrest had been set in motion when the suspect retreated into her house. She was not, I don't think she was under full-blown arrest. She was not, the circumstances wouldn't suggest to her that she was in physical custody at that point. But the arrest had been set in motion for the purposes of applying the Santana rule. I think Mr. Peterson was under arrest when the officer went to grab him after threatening that he would be placing him under arrest. So I think there's an analytical distinction between an arrest being set in motion and an actual arrest. And honestly, that makes sense because an officer needs to be able to enforce the law from a distance. If he's not with somebody at the moment he wants to place them into custody, he has to be able to say, stop, I need to talk to you. And if somebody flees at that point into their home, it only makes sense that under the Fourth Amendment, the officer should be able to apprehend that person.
So I guess now you've confused me a little bit because I'm not quite sure about, it seems to me there are a couple of points in time that at least I wasn't clear in the briefing, you know, what your position was. One is, you know, for the first issue, which is the reasonable articulable suspicion issue, when did the officer stop Mr. Peterson for the brief investigatory detention?
I agree with the appellant that that's likely at the point in time when the officer says stop.
Okay. So, and you're there, you're at the point in time, and I just want to make sure we're on the same page.
Yes. It's,
so Mr. Peterson has left his vehicle. He's walked toward the house. The officer has also parked his vehicle somewhere, has stepped out and verbally said stop somewhere outside of the home.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? Okay. And how about when did the officer arrest Mr. Peterson?
He arrested him, I think, at the earliest. There, in a different case, I might actually dispute the whether the arrest had occurred at that point in this case. But we're willing to accept for this case, at the earliest, the arrest occurred when he was grabbed by the officer. And at that point in time, he began to resist. And all that occurred is to maintain his balance, the trooper placed his foot beyond the threshold of the home. And that arrest was supported by probable cause for the driving while impaired, as well as the flight from the initial order to stop. And if Your Honor wants a sort of an analogous case, this court's decision in Steinbrenner, which is also cited in the brief, the officer was conducting a DWI investigation. There was a moment where the driver was able to flee from the officer. This was occurring in the driver's driveway, and he ran inside. And the officer was allowed to go inside and retrieve him. So I think the sequence is similar, although the probable cause for DWI there may have been developed at a slightly earlier point.
Counsel, does the record indicate either the distance or the amount of time that the officer followed the vehicle before the vehicle pulled into his residence, or before the appellant pulled into his residence?
Your Honor, not in any specific terms. I think the officer's testimony gives the picture that it's a relatively short period of time. I don't think he was following him for miles.
And he never activated his lights?
He did not, Your Honor. And just to be clear, even if a home entry did occur, the officer was in hot pursuit. At that point in time, he had probable cause to believe a DWI occurred. Under Paul, the officer could have entered the home to secure the arrest. He didn't even need to do that here. So in summary, the arrest was lawful regardless of whether a home entry occurred because the entry was incidental to the completion of a lawful arrest initiated before the entry occurred. The state simply asks that this court affirm Mr. Peterson's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenley.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any rebuttal?
Briefly, Your Honor. I think there was more than a foot across the door. The officer had to reach in at a minimum, even believing everything the officer says. He reached into the house. Mr. Peterson wasn't bobbing his head out the door so he could be grabbed or his arm. The trooper reached in and dragged him out of his house, and it took another officer to help him. He did not want to leave his house. When the trooper testified, I arrested him because he wouldn't come out of the house and talk to me. I don't believe that's a valid basis to arrest somebody for obstruction. You have a right not to leave your home, and you have a right not to answer questions. And when giving deference to the trooper, he testified at the initial hearing and the implied consent that this was not hot pursuit. The district court substituted its own judgment in that court order and said it was hot pursuit, even though the trooper said it wasn't and didn't believe it was. Also, giving deference to the trooper, he would be the one to know when an arrest was set in motion. And at the omnibus hearing, he testified that when Mr. Peterson walked in and shut his door, no arrest had been set in motion at that time. All he was doing was trying to talk to him about a brake light that was out, a petty misdemeanor traffic offense, which I don't believe justifies the trooper's conduct in pounding on the door and digging his foot in the threshold and demanding that Peterson come out of his house. And then when he refuses to come out of his house, then arresting him for obstruction. I don't think that was valid. And I just ask the court to look at the Brookins versus Commissioner of Public Safety. It's in the appendix. Very similar case. The officers came, knocked on the door. Guy opened the door, tried to shut it, and the officers forced their way in. I think it's A4. They shoved their way in and arrested him. And that this court found was not appropriate. And that'd be my rebuttal. Thank you for your time, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We'll have our decision out. That concludes our calendar.
All right.